Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC.
And now on BBC World Service, the documentary, Europe's Choice, a new series in which Alan Little looks at some of the key moments and issues that lie behind the current crisis in the European Union. The story begins with a defining moment of the 20th century.
It was one of those hinges on which history turns.
The people of Berlin, East and West, have spent the night celebrating their new freedom to travel across...
The 9th of November 1989 changed the shape and the destiny of our continent.
Well, it's amazing. It's what we have waited for 23 years or something.
I am born here in the city and I'm waiting to be free in the city.
But it was also a moment of hidden, unforeseen consequences.
The police commander on duty here at Checkpoint Charlie has suddenly announced that they can go over, even though they may not have the right documents, and they're simply charging now...
This programme for the BBC World Service looks at why the fall of the Berlin Wall put Europe on the road to a single currency, and ultimately to the current crisis. It's a story of how political ambition triumphed over economic reality, of how 17 nations married in haste and now repent at leisure. In 1989, many of Europe's leaders had lived through the Second World War. As young adults, they had helped build what would become the European Union. They had dreamed of a Europe with no internal borders and a single currency from the beginning, in the 1940s. But no one foresaw in the euphoria of that November night that the fall of the Berlin Wall would give that dream new energy and a new urgency.
I watched the scenes on television last night and again this morning because I felt one ought not only to hear about them, but see them. Because you see the joy on people's faces and you see what freedom means to them. It makes you realise...
But Britain, always the half-hearted European, quickly grew uneasy. Its Prime Minister had also lived through the Second World War. Douglas, now Lord Hurd, was Mrs. Thatcher's Foreign Secretary.
It wasn't that she feared the jackboots would march all over Europe. She was sometimes portrayed as believing that. She didn't believe that, I'm sure of that. She did believe, though, that if you added X million highly disciplined Prussians and Saxons to the existing German mix, you'd get something absolutely formidable. And she was egged on in this by Nick Ridley. You remember he was Secretary of State for the Environment then.
And there were others who egged her on apart from Nicholas Ridley. Who were they, do you think?
I put a lot of blame on President Mitterrand. She had a respect for President Mitterrand. He was several bad things. He was socialist and he was French and so on and so on. But she forgave those because he was so clever and knew so much history. And he played on that. He said to me every now and then, Monsieur le Ministre, c'est 14 encore une fois. It's 1914 all over again. And therefore, we and the Russians and you, the British, must stand up against it, as we did then. And this was music to her ears, really. And she kept on saying to me, oh, the French are on our side. But I knew that actually Mitterrand was discussing the whole question with Kohl on a completely different basis.
France had always seen the European community as a projection of French power and prestige on a continental scale. The old West Germany, with its sleepy capital at Bonn, caressing the Belgian border, was containable within that idea of Europe. This new Germany would shift the European centre of gravity dramatically to the east. President Mitterrand was worried. But unlike Mrs. Thatcher, he thought opposing German unification futile. He offered his support, but at a price. The historian Timothy Garton Ash.
The documents on this are by now absolutely clear. Most of the documents have been released. The price was an accelerated commitment to a timetable for European monetary union, a monetary union which Mitterrand saw as binding United Germany into Europe and preserving French leadership. The irony, of course, is that it's had precisely the opposite effect. It's not merely catalyzed, it's compelled the emergence of German leadership inside the Eurozone.
In Germany, too, the past is ever present. The spectre of hyperinflation haunts policymaking. Twice in the 20th century, Germans were ruined by it. Hyperinflation helped bring Adolf Hitler to power. The Deutschmark, introduced in 1948, was to the Germans so much more than a currency. It stood for a Germany reinvented after the nightmare of Nazism. Joachim Bitterlich was foreign affairs advisor to Chancellor Kohl and a principal architect of the single currency.
This was the symbol of the renaissance of Germany after the war. Reform, that currency reform, with the introduction of a Deutschmark. And the whole debate how to structure Germany as a state came 1 year later. The Deutschmark became the symbol of renaissance of Germany.
And so persuading the Germans to give it up was a very difficult thing.
Let's say it was nearly a mission impossible. And therefore we had to offer something to the Germans, what I would call the translation of a German model at the European level, the euro, with the independent central bank, the obligation of fighting against inflation.
This was Germany's price for agreeing to give up the cherished Deutschmark. The new European Central Bank would have to be modelled on the mighty German Bundesbank. It would have to be independent of government. Its defining task would be to control inflation. The French didn't like this at all.
The French model was no independent European Central Bank, and the economic model accompanying it was not federal at all, but centralized. Let's call it dirigistic.
State interventionist.
State interventionist. And our model was social market economy.
How difficult were the French on the question of the independence of the European Central Bank?
Well, it was not in their nature, but they knew exactly the Germans will never do it without independence.
Even so, the drive to monetary union gathered speed. Just 2 years after the fall of the wall, the 12 member governments gathered in the Dutch city of Maastricht.
As the ministers stepped forward to sign the treaty, a string orchestra played classical music.
An enlarged Europe will not be, cannot be, a centralised Europe with a single central power, a single central parliament. I think the logic is running against that.
The Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, signed on behalf of the government. His signature also on a separate protocol, allowing Britain to decide later if it wants to take part in a single currency, due to be in place by 1999 at the latest.
Britain and Denmark negotiated an opt-out, but the other 10 signed up for eventual membership of the single currency. They laid down strict criteria. To qualify for membership, governments must achieve low inflation, low national debt, and low budget deficits. Germany insisted on fiscal and financial discipline. And at the last minute, Germany added another condition. The new European Central Bank would be forbidden from issuing eurobonds to bail out any national government that was overspending. David, now Lord Williamson, was Secretary General of the European Commission throughout the negotiations.
It wasn't in drafts that floated around for quite a long time. So in the original version, there would have been more possibility to take on at European level commitments such as the ones which people are now arguing about.
So the way in which the treaty restricts the freedom of the European Central Bank, yep, was introduced to the treaty by the Germans.
As far as I recall, by the Germans.
Very late in the day.
Yep.
What do you think motivated that?
The same circumstances which have come to the head now. The German Constitutional Court had to protect their national position. They were signing up a treaty. They were giving away, as it always says in the German Constitutional Court's judgments, they were giving away the powers which belong to the German people, not to the German government, but to the German people.
The effect was to create a shared currency, but to rule out shared debt. The benefits of the single currency would be mutual, but there would be no mutualisation of the risks that went with it. When the ink was dry on the Maastricht Treaty, the criteria were clear. To get into the euro, each nation would have to prove that its public finances were very sound indeed. John, now Lord Kerr, was UK ambassador to the EU at the time of the Maastricht Treaty.
If you think back to 20 years to the Maastricht negotiation, when we were working all this out, my view was that it would be five, possibly six countries that would start. Never occurred to me that Italy or Spain, let alone Greece, would qualify.
European countries now settled to the task of getting their public finances ready. They did this in part through something called the exchange rate mechanism, a kind of monetary straitjacket that had been set up in the 1970s to try to limit fluctuations in the value of Europe's national currencies. Britain had joined the ERM in 1990. Sir Nigel Wicks served both at the British Treasury and on the European Monetary Committee, the body that created the single currency.
One of the objectives was actually how to deal with inflation. The Treasury was looking for a sort of holy grail. How can we control inflation?
The Germans had mastered inflation. They wanted exchange rate stability for a different reason, to protect their lucrative export markets. Separate currencies and fluctuating exchange rates meant interrupted sales. A sudden drop in the value of, say, the Italian lira made German exports suddenly unaffordable in Italy. The Germans came to see in separate currencies a means of protectionism, a way for national governments to erect artificial trade barriers. Dietrich von Kiel was German ambassador to the EU for much of the 1990s.
We wanted Italy to stop devaluating the lira. That had to do with such limited, but nevertheless, in the German political field, important things like Bavaria needing to continue to sell their surplus milk to Italy. Or Volkswagen wishing to keep the Fiat competition within certain limits. It's a political game always also. It's not only one of principles, not even in Germany.
In 1992, at the time of the Maastricht Treaty, 11 countries had joined the exchange rate mechanism, 10 of which were, in effect, pegging their currencies to the ever-dependable, ever-predictable Deutschmark. But Germany was paying a high price for reunification, and Deutschmark interest rates were high. Some of Europe's weaker currencies were now woefully overvalued. By September, it was clear that Italy was struggling. Sir Nigel Wicks sensed a tipping point. His boss, the minister charged with maintaining UK financial stability, Norman Lamont, was that evening at London's Royal Albert Hall, a guest of the BBC at the proms.
I got a message at home from an Italian colleague that they were liable to fall out. And this was the days before text messaging and things like mobile phones. And I had to get a message to Norman Lamont, who was in the box, the VIP box. And so I sort of passed him sort of cryptic messages. Look, I'm awfully afraid my Italian friend is very ill and I'm not going to show that he's going to survive the weekend. Perhaps we ought to have a word about funeral events and things like that.
So you had to speak to him in code?
Yes.
Why?
Because I couldn't actually say to the BBC people, can you tell Norman Lamont that the Italians are just about to fall out the ERM and we better think of a contingency plan? Maybe your music department would not have actually passed it on to the news department. I couldn't say that, so I had to talk in code.
Then, as now, the contagion spread. The markets turned on the pound. The value of sterling started tumbling. To stay in the ERM, the British government tried to defend the currency.
Tonight, a massive 5% hike in Britain's interest rates to shore up the ailing pound. It didn't work. Hopes of recovery smashed with warnings that mortgages could go through the roof and thousands...
Norman Lamont raised interest rates by 2% in the morning and then by a further 3% in the afternoon. To the markets, it looked like panic. It also looked hopeless. By the end of the day, he'd put them back down to where they'd started. The pound had lost 17% of its value.
The government has concluded that Britain's best interests are served by suspending our membership of the exchange rate mechanism.
The effort needed to keep the pound pegged to the mighty Deutschmark was too much for the British economy to bear. It came to be known as Black Wednesday. It was an early lesson in the limits and dangers of a one-size-fits-all currency union.
Despite these clear warning signs about the dangers of binding so many national currencies into one signal, nonetheless, the steam train to monetary union...
still steamed ahead.
Sir Nigel Wicks, Britain's man on the European Monetary Committee, was still busy in Brussels building the single currency. Shouldn't Black Wednesday have been a warning that national economies needed their currencies to be flexible in value?
But you see, what... the mainland Europeans argued at the time, was they argued the reverse. They said because it was so difficult to run an ERM, which you had independent currencies, and those independent currencies were effectively dominated by what decisions the Bundesbank took, the answer was to have one currency where you had interest rate decisions for the single currency area taken by the ECB, the European Central Bank, where everyone was round the table.
And so the steamship single currency sailed blissfully on. Maastricht had set notional deadlines for Europe's national currencies to lock themselves together. 1997, if possible, 1999 at the latest. In 1995, 3 years after Maastricht, a young civil servant at the French finance ministry, called Jacques Lafitte, got a phone call asking if he'd like to relocate to Brussels to work on the euro project.
What kick-started the process after this long period of inertia?
Frankly, that's simply my commissioner realizing that we were not ready. We were not ready to introduce the single currency. We were not even ready to produce a paper who would explain how we would do that.
And who was driving it politically?
Well, in a way, the treaty. Quite simply, I mean, the treaty had been ratified with the opt-outs that we all know, but we had to implement the treaty. The Commission would have been guilty of not doing its job if we had not proposed the appropriate transition scenario and the secondary legislation that had to come with it. At the time, between ourselves, we thought, oh gosh, 2 years to go. I mean, we have no design for the coins and notes. Even for the simplest things, we had a problem.
Coinage was the least of their concerns. The key question was who would qualify for membership in the first wave. Which countries would fulfil the strict Maastricht criteria? Which economies would really be ready?
Europe at the time was essentially divided between the countries who would potentially fulfil the criteria, but were not so keen on moving to a European currency, and the ones who potentially would not fulfil the criteria, who were far more positive about giving up their national currency.
12 of the European Union's 15 member governments wanted in. Britain, Denmark and Sweden stood back. Sir Nigel Wicks.
The other member states didn't want to be regarded as second-class citizens, and you found that there was an internal political dynamic which made them want to be really close members of Europe. The Spaniards and the Portuguese had not long come out of dictatorship. So they wanted to be part of it. Similarly with the Greeks. And if being part of the club was being member of the monetary union, they would be members of the monetary union.
Very political dynamic, not much economics going on.
Not much economics to that.
Many in Northern Europe wanted the euro phased in gradually, to start with perhaps 5 or 6 members whose economies were truly ready, and to grow from there. The Dutch were not happy. Their former finance minister, Wim Duisenberg, was an early doubter.
Mr. Duisenberg, who eventually became the first president of the European Central Bank, went on the record in January 1995 saying that Europe was not ready and it would take at least one more generation before we can possibly introduce a single currency.
So there were doubts from some very, very serious people about whether Europe was ready for this venture. Why were those doubts in the end overcome? Why did the pro-euro, the pro-single currency camp prevail?
Well, first, there were a lot of people in the pro-euro camp, huh? Make no mistake. But it's clear that their Chancellor Kohl played a decisive role.
And why did he want it?
The Chancellor Kohl that we knew in 95 wanted the euro for at least one very good reason, which is that the same Chancellor Kohl already wanted the euro back in 88, 89.
You have to look back at the whole history of European integration, which had happened through the so-called Monnet method or functionalist method, which is that you go almost by stealth through economic integration to political integration.
Timothy Garton-Ash.
Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand thought that, of course, a closer fiscal union and political union would follow monetary union, and they wanted that to happen. They thought it would necessarily follow, but it didn't.
Jacques Lafitte told the BBC World Service that it was an open secret among the technocrats putting the single currency together that Europe's southern tier was not ready. But Europe's political leaders, not the supposedly unaccountable eurocrats of the Commission, but the democratically elected national governments themselves, did not want to listen.
Italy, Spain, Portugal and Greece, but they were in different situations. Spain was a very impressive country in terms of public finances, for instance. Of course, we had our doubts that they were completely ready when we looked, for instance, at their balance of payments. Competitiveness was not one of the criteria. So the only thing we could do in practice in the convergence reports or the economic assessments that we did twice a year was to say to Spain, well, maybe you want to do something about your labor market and your competitiveness and your unit labor costs. Italy was a country that a lot of us thought, but we couldn't tell people, was not really ready. But they were desperate on joining from day one, absolutely desperate.
So it was your view that Italy was not ready. Was that view widely shared?
Behind closed doors, yes.
Why did nobody tell the truth?
Because we have had in Europe, not just with the euro, a big political correctness problem over the decades. This good old tradition of not pointing the finger at any other member state just to make sure that the other member state would not point the finger at you someday. It would have been difficult unless they would have remained very far away from the criteria.
But they were far away from the criteria.
Well, no. They had a special tax, did some massaging of the figures, but not much, and they were not the only ones.
How many countries did you think in your mind would be ready by the end of the decade?
The vision that was shared by most EU officials. But again, we had to shut our big mouth, and we're just smallish technocrats at the end of the day, was Germany, Benelux, Austria, France, plus the countries to the west and to the north, so potentially Finland and Ireland.
So 6 or 7?
Or 6 to 8, something like that.
In 1999, 11 countries locked their currencies together, Greece making it 12 2 years later. This was almost twice the number many believed suitable. But political imperatives drove the whole process, and at key moments they trumped economic better judgment. The Europeans, in their post-1989 euphoria, allowed hope to silence legitimate doubt. Next week on the BBC World Service, I'll examine how that pattern would continue, with even the Germans casually and disastrously disregarding what were meant to be strict, legally binding fiscal rules, as the juggernaut of monetary union rolled on, with even the Greeks on board.
We always saw the head of the statistical agency of Greece that compiled all these statistics on the deficits, inflation, etc. We used to call him the magician because he made inflation disappear and then he also made the deficits disappear.
Europe's Choice was presented by Alan Little and produced by Jane Beresford.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.